All the latest business news from WA, delivered daily. At close of business, news briefing.
Good afternoon and welcome to At Close of Business. I'm Jordan Murray with your Thursday afternoon headlines. Protesters have sprayed a Woodside logo on an iconic painting at the state's art gallery as they continue campaigning against the state's biggest energy project. The Frederick McCubbin work, Down on His Luck, was painted in 1889 and was on display at the gallery as part of its dispossession series. Earlier today, artist and activist Joanna Partikas sprayed a yellow Woodside Energy logo on the work and glued her hand to the gallery wall. It's understood, however, that the painting is protected by a Perspex cover, ironically a plastic derived from oil. Woodside is developing a $17 billion project to pipe gas from the Scarborough field off of Western Australia's coast to a new liquefaction train at the Pluto LNG operation on the Burrup Peninsula. The Burrup is also home to many pieces of ancient Indigenous rock art, estimated to be between 4,000 and 30,000 years old. Woodside has received a series of environmental approvals for the project, but has faced criticisms from opponents concerned about its carbon emissions and impact on the ancient rock art. Business News understands a 37-year-old person is in WA police custody and assisting with inquiries. Elsewhere today, the state government has reached across the aisle and named a former Liberal government health minister to help assess WA's pandemic management and response. Premier Mark McGowan said today the assessment will be completed by the middle of this year and will consider subjects such as the procurement of rapid antigen tests, the state's vaccine rollout, and its controversial hard border policy. John Day will help oversee that review, having previously served as health minister in the Court and Barnett governments. Crucially, though, none of the review's three panel members have a background in virology, a point the Premier argued was moot given the severity of COVID-19 was not in question. Turning to property now, and Far East Consortium has lodged a 23-storey apartment proposal for the Perth City Link, adding to the multi-billion dollar investment for the area. The international property developer is proposing a residential development on the intersection of Rowe Street and Warden Gardens as part of the state government's attempt to reconnect Perth CBD with Northbridge. Perth City Link covers 13.5 hectares and is expected to attract $5.2 billion in investment, with $3 billion of that coming from the private sector. Edith Cowan University City Campus forms part of the Perth City Link. Far East Consortium's residential complex will cost $80 million, according to its submission to Development WA. And finally, Northern Star Resources recorded a slight increase in gold production for the December quarter and remains on track to meet its 2023 target. The Perth-based gold miner's shares were up to $12 after its Kalgoorlie, Yandal and Alaskan project Pogo's operations produced a total of 400,000 ounces of gold for the quarter. Northern Star Managing Director Stuart Tonkin said all three production centres achieved positive net mine cash flow after funding capital requirements, with the company on track to deliver on its 2023 financial year guidance. And coming up next, I speak to senior journalist Matt McKenzie about what critics are getting wrong ahead of this year's referendum on a First Nations voice to Parliament.
The business world is teeming with opportunities to succeed, and every day is a chance for the ambitious to learn, know, and grow. Over recent years, we have built the greatest business journalist team in WA, delivering you the most trusted, comprehensive, intelligent, and up-to-date news across every sector, every platform, every day. No fluff, all informative stuff. At Business News, we believe progress boils down to one simple habit. That is, what you subscribe to today shapes what you will become tomorrow. Subscribe to success. Subscribe to Business News. Visit businessnews.com.au/subscribe for more information.
Welcome back to At Close of Business. I'm Matt McKenzie, joined today by Jordan Murray. How are you, Jordan?
I'm doing fine, thank you, Matt.
Great to hear. Now, a very important issue in Australia that I think most Australians, probably almost all Australians, are very passionate about and want to see resolved for the better is Indigenous disadvantage or closing the gap. I think pretty much anyone you speak to has an idea about how it should be done. Certainly in the business community, there are a lot of reconciliation action plans and different mechanisms that people are using, and it's really heartwarming. Perhaps, unfortunately, it's taking longer to close the gap than what we might have hoped. One important issue of policy around this is the voice to Parliament, and Jordan, you've written about it in your opinion piece in the latest edition of our magazine.
I should preface this episode today by saying that I don't take any firm stance for or against The Voice. What has started to bother me a little bit in recent months is I feel there is a certain level of disingenuous questioning around The Voice to Parliament. What will it do? What are its functions? Who will sit on this proposed body? And I feel as if, to some extent, those questions have been addressed. Now, we've spoken about this in the office before, Matt. I understand that the Federal Indigenous Affairs Minister, Linda Burney, has not committed to the key recommendations of the co-design report, which was commissioned under the Morrison government. But I think that there is enough there to vaguely outline what this body will do if, when Australians go to the polls later this year, they do vote in favour of an Indigenous voice to Parliament. And I guess the point of what I was trying to make in this opinion piece in the latest edition is there is a key difference, I think, between disagreeing to The Voice on constitutional grounds, which I think is entirely valid, and disingenuously questioning elements of it that, yes, while they haven't been technically agreed to, I think give us a vague idea or a general idea of what this body will look like if it is supported in a referendum.
So let's get into this, because assuming that the government does decide to accept all of the recommendations of that report, and of course they might not, and it might end up totally different, but if they do, how would it look?
So I was working off the recommendations of the report, which was, again, it was commissioned during the Morrison government under Ken Wyatt, who was Indigenous Affairs Minister at the time. He's now assisting in the Yes campaign, I believe. It's a very dense read, what was in that report. It consulted 9,000 people, or more than 9,000 people, including organisations, and it ran for an 18-month period, and there's a lot of stuff in this report, and I understand it is quite difficult to get through that. I'm not saying that to be sarcastic or smarmy. Nobody has the time to read hundreds of pages of reports. But when you get into it, there is a very general idea of what we would have if that report was committed to. So it's would be a 24-member body. It would constitute Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander members. It would consult on their views on laws, policies, programs that affect Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, particularly on matters of, and I quote here, social, spiritual and economic well-being. Parliamentarians and public servants would have an obligation to consult The Voice, preferably as early as possible, but its remit, it would be narrow, and it would only directly pertain to matters that affect First Nations people. Broadly speaking as well, there'd be transparency measures allowed for, and they'd be similar to those that already pertain to federal MPs, and there'd also be local and regional bodies which would be implemented to complement the National Voice. Now, I understand under the legislated model that was advocated for by the previous government, they would come first before there is a national body, so there are legitimate questions over which one would come first, the national, the regional and the local bodies. But again, this is just a very broad outline of what this body would do. It doesn't appear as if, and I'm not going to name people specifically, but there are some implications that there would be an ability to consult on matters of, say, defence or on other aspects of government spending that don't directly affect First Nations people. I don't think, based on this co-design report, that that is what this body will be allowed to do.
I want to get into that question in a moment, because there could be some interesting outcomes from that. But just in terms of who selects the panel, can you tell us, does the report go into any detail as to whether Indigenous communities get to vote for their representatives, or will it just sort of be someone from government saying, no, we're going to pick X, Y, and Z person?
To the best of my knowledge, in the model that's proposed within the co-design report, the local and regional voices, they will decide how they will be elected. So whether that be the state government appoints those people who sit on that body, or whether there are direct elections from communities of interest. And then those bodies will then select who sits on the National Voice itself.
I'm interested about this question because you talked about, would it apply to defence? And I guess this goes to something many years ago when, well, it wasn't that many years ago, but quite a few years ago when there was the discussion starting about putting in the Constitution, you know, an acknowledgement of Indigenous people as being the first Australians, basically. There was some debate about how that might potentially be interpreted by a court or by the High Court, or whether particular justices might use it to apply it in this way or that way. And readers might kind of be curious as to why that is. But certainly if you read constitutional amendments or you read how the Constitution looked 100 years ago and then see how these things are applied 100 years later, it does often look very different. So I think that perhaps one area where there might be a bit of debate about this is exactly how broad do the powers look? Because we might say, well, defence doesn't apply. But then again, I mean, it does apply in a sense. Like if you're an Indigenous person, one of the most important things that a government can do, as with any other person, is to keep the country safe, for example. So does it have to be issues that specifically only affect Indigenous people, or that mostly affect Indigenous people, or that affect Indigenous people at all? I mean, is there any sort of outline as to how that might look?
I'm fairly certain it has to be very specific. As I understand it, it tends to pertain to matters like native title. So again, just policies that directly affect First Nations people. But I think as well, there probably is remit to challenge that within the courts if it gets to a point where that happens, which surely it will happen. But then again, I guess that also comes down to the design of the legislation in question. Broadly speaking, I don't think it's wrong or incorrect to have this debate about the voice. And I do hope that there is quite a robust debate about this, because as you point out there are implications for constitutional law, and there is implications to how this affects government operations. I just get a bit annoyed sometimes when I hear people in bad faith say things like, well, I'm just asking questions. And as journalists, sometimes we're guilty of, you know, just asking questions. We make an assertion and then we just put a question mark at the end of it, and then
we
see what happens, and we've protected ourselves. But I think with a debate like this, I think as you were getting at earlier, this is a debate that a lot of people take very seriously. In fact, I would hazard a guess that there are exceedingly few people who don't think that more should be done to help our First Nations people here in Australia, which is why I hope that some of what I've interpreted to be bad faith questioning isn't carried through in the months ahead.
Well, whatever happens, I think we can all agree that we're certainly hopeful that the outcome is better outcomes on the ground for people, for First Nations people. And Jordan, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat to us today about your opinion piece.
Thank you.
The latest business news delivered daily. Subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to your podcasts. For all the latest business news, visit businessnews.com.au.